This message comes from NPR sponsor Hulu. Don't miss the new docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History. From memes to movements, see how this powerful online community shapes culture and society. Black Twitter, A People's History is now streaming on Hulu.
Hey, y'all, from NPR, I'm Sam Sanders. It's been a minute. Most Fridays on the show, I look back on the week of news with a few friends. But this week, going to mix it up. I'm taking some time off from the news. Feels good. Going to bring you not one, but two conversations from the last year of the show with two actors who are both up for awards at the 2018 Emmys next month. Later on in this episode, you'll hear my chat with Rachel Brosnahan. She's up for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for her work in Amazon's The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. But first, my chat with Brian Tyree Henry. You know him from the hit FX show Atlanta. That show was up for Best Comedy Series. And Brian is up for Outstanding Supporting Actor for his work playing Alfred Paperboy Miles, perhaps my favorite character on the show. Paperboy is this up-and-coming rapper who is managed by his cousin, Earn. Earn is played by the show's creator and star, you may have heard of him, Donald Glover. Now, just a warning, when you hear Brian and I talking first, you'll hear the N-word. We did not bleep it. After Brian, I'll come back to introduce Rachel, and we'll be back to our regular schedule next week. All right, enjoy. All right, Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that I can recall a better first season of a show.
Wow.
Y'all got all the acclaim. All the awards.
Yeah.
I can't even count the number of critics that said this is the best comedy of the year.
Yeah.
Did you expect any of that going into the project?
I didn't expect to ever work. Like, I didn't expect to ever be, like, on a show on FX, like, with Donald Glover doing a comedy where I could say nigga on, like, cable. Like,
and
I
all the time. Y'all say
like,
all the time.
Like, I didn't expect that there would be a show about, like, the town that I've always loved. Like, I went to college in Atlanta.
It's Morehouse,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, and it was, like, Atlanta was the best, and still is to me one of the best cities, like, you know, second to New York. I'm not going to go
You
crazy.
Like New York?
I love it here.
Are you living here mostly now?
Yeah,
or
I'm okay. A resident of Harlem, man. I
oh,
live
I didn't
here.
Know that.
Yeah,
okay.
I've been living here for 11 years.
I was in Tryon Park this morning running.
Ah, wait, so you were, like, close to the hood?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Like, this is home.
What I love about Paperboy in the show, he's quiet a lot, but you can see that the wheels are always turning.
All the time.
And then when he does talk, he says so much with, like, a line. Like, there's this line in the premiere of the new season where Donald Glover's character is trying to negotiate this beef, and you call him, and he wants to put you on speakerphone, and you say, as Paperboy, so deadpan, "You could take me off speakerphone." And it's one line, but it contains multitudes.
I mean, I think that's the gift of what we do, right? Like, I think that that's, and you know, I learned a lot of that from my family.
How
you
so?
Know, like, because, you know, you got, you like, being both of us are black men, and, you know, we were raised by black women.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's the thing of, like, public and private things that
oh,
you
yeah.
do. And some of the things that our mothers neglected to tell us is, like, when is it okay to do the private things in public? You know
yeah.
what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And I'll never forget my mother when we would go to movies, because I'm the youngest. So
at least
like,
you got to go to the movies. We were so Pentecostal growing up. We couldn't go to the movies.
Now, let me tell you something. We didn't go to the movies when they came out. We went to the dollar movie, right? To the dollar movie.
Yeah.
So this shit already been out for like 6 months. And like, you're going to the dollar movie.
And all your friends and told you the whole plot.
No, you're already like, well, like, I mean, like, the way I learned Disney was like book on tape and then like the dollar movie. So like, we go to the dollar movie. And I remember, like, even at the dollar movie, you had a child discount. Now, mm-hmm. it usually would be like, you had to be like 8 and under.
Uh-huh.
To get the child discount, and my mother was going up there flossing. She was like, yeah, you know, we've got 2 adults and, like, 4 kids. And
how old were y'all, though?
I was 11.
And you were the youngest.
And I'm the baby. So my sisters knew the drill to just shut up. But I was like, but Ma, I'm 10. And I just remember her looking at me.
Oh,
like,
abort.
Looking at me, and she was like, okay, yep, I guess that's what it is now. We got it. And when I go in this theater, and she was like, you know what to do next time, right?
You know.
And I was like, I don't even want to see the movie now.
Yeah.
I was like,
yeah.
Are we that broke that you are so upset that you didn't get 50 cents off this? Man, and it was just like, look, like, you just know the look.
So Paperboy is channeling your mom.
Yeah, man, honestly.
I love that.
Like, honestly, like, there's a... Because in a way, he's everybody's mom and everybody's father, too. You know what I mean? Like, he really is. Like, I'm the one that has the connection with Earn's parents, not Earn. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not... He, like, I'm the one that's there kind of, like, with your daughter that you haven't, like, been with. And, like, I have to be everybody's mom and everybody's dad. And that's the thing about this season.
I never thought about it that way, which you were spot on.
Yeah, and I was like, and in this season, you see it a lot that it's, like... It's wearing on him a little bit.
He does, in a way, carry so much of the emotional weight.
Yeah.
I love
that. The thing is like, he, I don't know, like, Alfred, like, when I, like, and someone said, they were like, every time we talk about Alfred, like, you light up, there's something about, because I'm very protective of him. Like, he, there's something, that's why I never refer to him as Paperboy. Like, I'm like, that's what y'all get to talk to him. I'll talk about him as, like.
But he's Alfred.
That, like, he's Alfred, man.
I apologize now for the disrespect.
No, it's all good. But, Alfred. I mean, like, it's just what you, because you only are able to call him Al or Alfred unless you're within his circle. You know that phrase, no squares in my circle. So, like, he's very much like, he's very much like, you got to earn it. You
Who
know?
Writes Alfred's lyrics? Oh, I love that song. Play it, Brent.
Wait, which song?
Paperboy, Paperboy.
Oh, Paperboy. Paperboy, Paperboy. Always about that Paperboy.
If you ain't on your grind, then you flexing, you's a hater boy. Did you write that?
No, I definitely didn't write that. That all that goes to Donald Glover.
I can hear this
Glover.
On the radio now.
Yeah, that's the thing. Paperclip, yeah, I need a paperclip. And this season, there's supposed to be a new single.
Are y'all going to, like, glee this stuff up and, like, put the songs from the show on the radio?
Well, you know what? If you go to FX Now, the app, you can actually go.
Nice plug.
Yeah, I mean, I'm good at this. All right, guys, I'm
You're
good
a,
at this.
How do you say a radio
Just
professional?
But if you go to the FX Now app, which I discovered, they will show you each song that's in each episode from season one.
Huh.
Like, and it's really brilliantly done. Like, it will show you the artwork of the album and what, like, it will tell you play by play, episode by episode, what song was
And you
used.
Guys were using a bunch of music, like, from the culture right
yeah,
now
man,
in the show.
Like,
to
that's
open
Donald. That's
the show.
Donald and Steven.
So Donald
man.
Was doing the
yeah.
music stuff.
Let's talk about how slick Donald is. Like, the fact
sure.
that Donald just won a Grammy for an album that he was doing while we were filming the first season and nobody knew. Like, I was like, dude, when did you
Wait,
have
he was
time?
Doing his latest album while
yeah.
also doing Atlanta?
Yes. If you look in episode 9, in the back, there, like, when he's in the study of the white dude for Juneteenth,
yeah.
you will see the album cover of
Awaken,
of
Awaken
My
Love.
Love. Yeah, right there. It's sitting right there. And I was like, what?
Mind
I was
blown.
Like, so that means that this dude was literally, and I was, because I went up and down, I was like, we were together every day.
And he was
like,
making the album behind your back.
Like, I was like, what weird, like, black hole do you jump into in another universe and create this masterpiece? But that's, he was doing it while we were there, man.
How does he get the energy for it? That's
He doesn't sleep. I don't think he, I part of me thinks he's like a cyborg. You know, but I mean, like, I can do all things through Donald Glover. You know what I mean? Like, there's something, you know.
I love it.
He's brilliant, man.
I
he's
love
a
it.
Brilliant, brilliant man.
So he wrote the lyrics.
Yeah, I think him and his brother both, and that's his brother rapping. That's not me. That's his brother's voice. That's
Stephen
Glover's
Glover.
Voice. Yeah, man.
What do you want? So much of the show is this wonderful social critique and satire, and y'all are saying some interesting things about the state of things. I'm thinking about the episode where you're dealing with, I'm in the first season, what's it called, Montague?
Jesus Christ, yeah.
Where you basically are on a fake
talk show. Within a fake network.
Within a fake network.
With fake commercials.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the big thing, and like the overarching theme is the way in which our society now can police speech.
Yeah.
And there was like a bigger thing in there.
Yeah.
Looking at the show that is doing such great social critique and satire, what do you want watchers and viewers to learn from Alfred? What is Alfred's lesson to us?
That he's not thinking about you. That he's really not thinking about you, because what he has to do is he has to go day by day
yeah.
figuring out exactly where he's going to be, especially now that he is Paperboy to
yeah.
people.
Oh,
so I think that that's where Alfred is getting...
Yeah.
And it's going, especially this
season. Hearing you say that Alfred is not worried about y'all, like there's, in so many ways in the culture right now, it is almost criminal to say that you don't care.
Yeah, I know.
You know?
I know.
And like it is refreshing to see so many parts of the show and of Alfred's character kind of say, I don't care.
No, I'm just not here
I'm
for
just
it,
like,
but...
I'm trying to do me.
What I will say about Alfred this season is, you know, he's coming to his own sense of, like, appearance. Like, you know, he takes pride in the way he looks. He takes pride in the people he's with. But I don't think he knows the Dow yet. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't think he still has Google alerts of himself yet. Like, I don't think he's ever going to be the kind of person to do his own publicity of, like, yo, that's me. Yo, that's da-da-da-da. Because as soon as he celebrates himself, as you even, if you look back at the first episode of the first season, he tries to holler at a girl and is like, that's me on the radio. And she's like, so what? And now all of a sudden he's back again.
Yeah.
And I feel like those things constantly keep happening with him. And he has to constantly not reinvent.
Reset.
I guess reset. Yeah. Or reinvent the way he sees himself in a way. Like not so much reinvent the whole machine, but like.
Yeah.
Because like the world will constantly keep him in a place of like, nah, son. Like, nah.
Have you had to reset?
Every day. You ain't even got to finish it.
All right. In what ways? I want to know. Tell me.
I mean, it's the thing about humility, you know what I mean? Like, and like being completely humble to what's around you. Like, I'm so glad to be, there is nothing greater to me than literally getting up again, being back in New York, even if it's slushy, mushy, or whatever the hell it is.
Yeah, well, it literally was everything.
Yeah, it was all
snow,
that.
It was snow, it was rain, it was sleep today.
It was literally like all that.
I hated it.
And going to rehearsal, to be in this box with, for 8 hours or 6 hours, what have you, with three other actors and a director and a writer, it is literally one of the best things in my life.
So you're saying that you're rehearsing a play right now?
Yes, right now as we speak.
Can you talk about it?
Yeah, it's called Lobby Hero, written by Kenneth, Academy Award winning Kenneth Lonergan. It stars this amazing actress who I adore named Belle Powley, who I did a movie with last year with Matthew McConaughey called White Boy Rick. And it stars Michael Cera, of course, of Superbad, Scott Pilgrim fame.
He
Michael
seems
Cera,
cool.
He's amazing. He's the most amazing Canadian I've ever met.
Which is a high bar, because Canadians are pretty amazing.
I love Canada.
I really do.
You know, I don't know what it's people's problem is. I was like, I love Canada.
Yeah.
like, I've got great friends from Canada. So.
Yeah.
And, of course, Chris Evans. I mean, like, you know, I don't want to just call him out for Captain America. He does other great movies like Gifted and stuff like that. But it's just the four of us. And it's all about this. You know, I'm a security guard. Michael's a security guard. And Chris and Bell are police officers. And something like situations happen.
Okay.
You know, and this was written 17 years ago. And the things that are addressed in this play are still...
Really?
Happening. So, you know, there's still sexism on the police force.
Yeah.
There's still, you know, racism when it comes to, like, how the NYPD handles crimes, when it comes to race and stuff like that. And, like, it's all there. It's all there. And it is literally just four people in this lobby.
When is it going to be... able to be consumed by the public.
Well, the previews start March 1st, which is the same day that Atlanta Robin season premieres as well. So if you don't want to see me on TV and you want to see me on the stage, you can come to the first preview.
Just do both, everybody.
Or do both.
Do
you
both.
You know, like, what am I saying? Like, or do both.
So you got the play, but you're also, from what I've read, you're working on 6 movies this year?
8.
Look at you.
I'll try. Trying to catch up to Hans, you know, to Lando Calrissian up in here, man. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to get with Domino, you know?
Yeah. Can you talk about those?
Yeah. So, coming soon this month, there's going to be a romantic comedy called Irreplaceable You coming out, starring Gugu and Bathara and Mikhail Huseman and Christopher Walken. And it's going on Netflix February the 16th.
I love how you just dropped and Christopher Walken.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, because he's a staple in New York. Like, you don't really have to, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
Like, how, you know.
Yeah, so that's one.
That's one. Then I did a movie with Viola Davis and directed by Steve McQueen. It's got Colin Farrell as well and Daniel Kaluuya from Get Out. Academy Award nominee. Daniel, who's one of my great friends. I'm so proud of
Look
him.
Get you friends with everybody.
I mean, you gotta be friends. No squares in my circle. So,
so
that's
that.
Widows. That comes out in the fall.
Okay.
I also did a movie with Taylor Schilling called Family, which should be coming to South by Southwest soon.
Okay.
Then I'm doing White Boy Rick with Matthew McConaughey, you know, Jennifer Jason Leigh, and Belle Powley, who's in the play.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Something else. Oh, Hotel Artemis, which I did with my best friend Sterling K. Brown.
I wanted to get into that.
Two-time Emmy winner, you know, and Golden Globe winner.
Y'all, like, called each other the day when y'all both got nominated, right?
Yeah, we did. We did. We, like, I mean, he's my best friend. Like, I love him.
That.
Like, and then, you know, I was on his show and got an Emmy nomination because I decided the swagger jacket.
And you sang.
I did sing. Yeah, I did an original song. Yeah.
Standing at the station. Oh, it's queued up. We don't know what to say. I'm just continually, the more you talk about these things you're in and looking at this work on This Is Us compared to Atlanta, you are such a versatile actor.
Thank you, man.
Like, not a lot of people can do all of these different things. Is there one lesson or truth you've come to find out when it comes to being able to be that versatile of an actor? Like, what is the secret?
The only thing that has helped me, man, is, like, literally taking in the life that's going on around you and having the time of your damn life. Like, it's just, it's been a pleasure, you know. Like, I was reading this quote from Shonda Rhimes where she's like, I'm not lucky, just say I'm a badass. You know what I mean? She has this quote about, like, not being lucky, how she works really hard.
And
because people will always constantly tell me all the time, well, you're lucky you. You're lucky. Like,
that's what do you
like,
say when they tell you that?
I don't say. I act. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not a person of words. I'd rather show you rather than tell you because, like, no matter how often that I'm always underestimated or overlooked, I can hear you. And I'm like, that's great that you can tell me that, but I'm not thinking about you. So what I'm gonna go do is I'm gonna go over here and do this. So therefore you can sit down and watch this and be like, oh, well, he wasn't thinking about me. So, you know, I don't know, man. Like, I just love what I do. And I love it because of the people that I'm around and the art that's being made and the things that are being said. I mean, like, if I just sit back and just wait a second, like, I really believe that the universe will put me where I'm supposed to be. I'm not a religious person. I'm very, you know, spiritual and, you know, I've been through all kind of gamuts of whatever that is. But it's something like I do work hard. I work very, very hard, just not in the ways that people may expect.
My like mantra every day is like the universe provides.
Yeah.
And sometimes you gotta just like sit there long enough to see what it's saying.
Or then you dig your heels in and get yourself to action and figure that out too, you know?
Yeah. But there's this idea I think that like being able to just kinda work hard, be ready, be prepared, but be open to like where life takes you.
And look, and be honest, because like let me tell you something. Like, nothing in the world told me that I would be doing this show called Atlanta that would then be this huge thing that it became, and that my mother would leave me on the day that we wrapped. Like, nothing said that would happen. Like, nothing said.
And the backstory for those hearing this: your mother died the day
that we wrapped Atlanta in a very bad freak car accident. Oh. You know what I mean? And so for me, it was like, okay, well, you banked on her being here. You know what I mean? You banked on the fact that like, I was going to take her on a road trip. Like,
on a road trip.
Man, I was going to take her everywhere. I was like, oh, you've never heard of Martha's Vineyard? Let's go. Huh. Oh, you've never been to like the Cloisters? Let's go. Or you've never been to the Hamptons? Let's go. You know, like, let me just at least show you that, you know, your son is, I'm ready to get you. I think I was like going to take her like on a white man finding cruise. I was like, you ain't never slept with a white dude? Like, let's get you a white dude, mom. Like, let's go. I'm not joking. Like, that was what I wanted. And, you know, like, I just remember we were at the wrap party, and I was having the time of my life, and I remember it doing a torrential downpour, and I was just happy because there's some people who are like, you feel it when it happens, or you didn't feel anything. Really? All I felt was that I was happy. I had talked to her before I went to this party. Mm-hmm. I had done da-da-da. Mm-hmm. And then the next morning, like, just like that, she's gone. So it's like, you don't really know. That was the one thing in my 34 years that I hadn't accounted for, was that I would have to go through this without my mom.
Yeah.
And so it's like, now I have no choice in this world but to completely do all the things that she saw in me beyond. Like, I am not thinking about y'all. You know what I mean? Like,
I'm thinking about her.
I'm thinking about what I have to do for her, for me. And if these are the gifts that are put inside of me that she wants me to go out there and do, then I'm going to do them, damn it. But I don't have to share that with everybody about that process.
Yeah.
And I think that all of us need to figure that out about ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I think all of us need to understand that it's okay to keep some to yourself. Like, you don't have to share. Ain't nobody asking you to make no Barnes & Noble bestseller because you want to give everybody life advice. Like, no.
Just do
it's
you.
It's really okay to keep some to yourself and move through that, because at the end of the day, we all are individuals and we are all nothing but stories anyway. So what's your story?
Yeah.
You know?
I think your mother would like Atlanta.
I'm sure she would. She pops up in it quite a bit. You'll see.
Huh.
Because you know that Alfred doesn't have his mother. You know, so I was like, well, that's interesting. My mother was alive before that happened. Like, I remember saying that line. I was like, yeah, he doesn't have his mom.
Huh.
And then all of a sudden, you know.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, boy. Well, now what is that?
Huh.
So that's why I'm very close to Alfred and very protective of Alfred, because like we are kind of like one of the same cloth, you know what I mean? And,
yeah.
And I'm not one of those actors, you know, I'm no Daniel Day-Lewis, but you know, I'm not a big...
Daniel, get at us.
Yeah, I'm not a big... This is his last movie. He ain't doing nothing after this.
Allegedly. He's going to retire like Jay-Z did.
Right, right.
Remember Jay-Z
right.
retired like three times?
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just... try to be open to what life is gonna show
that.
Me, man. And like, open. You just never know what's gonna go, but, you know.
The universe provides.
The universe will provide.
Okay, time for a quick break. When we come back, Brian talks about his friendship with actor Sterling K. Brown from a little show called This Is Us. And later, I talk to Brian's fellow Emmy nominee, Rachel Brosnahan. All right, BRB.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dreams. Remember the X-Files, the show with the never-ending supply of paranormal problems and shoulder pads? Now you can watch it for free. Dreams is broadcasting the original series on Thursdays, starting from the beginning. Dreams is a new TV channel for your phone. It's free with no login. Download the free Dreams app for iPhone or Android and tune in on Thursdays. Support also comes from Fracture. Fracture turns your favorite digital memories into meaningful photo decor by printing them directly on glass. They come ready to display out of the box, including the wall hanger or optional stand. Fracture prints are handmade in Gainesville, Florida. Give a unique gift or focus on the moments that tell your story. It's Been a Minute listeners can save 15% on their first order by visiting fractureme.com/minute.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. The Emmys are approaching, so this week we're doing a special series of Emmy nominees and people from nominated shows like Atlanta, Saturday Night Live, Last Week Tonight, and Insecure. So check out this week's Emmy series on Fresh Air.
Before we go, can we talk a bit more about your good friend Sterling K. Brown?
Yeah!
And yeah,
that dude.
Yeah, go ahead. That dude, he seems awesome.
He's one of the most amazing people. Like, I honestly don't think I would be as able to talk about what I'm talking about when it comes to my enjoyment and excitement of acting and performing if it weren't for him, you know?
Like, why is that?
Because we're both geeks when it comes to that, you know what I mean? Like, we met at Sundance years ago. There was a Sundance Theater Lab where I met, a lot of great people.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, Terrell Alvin McCraney, who wrote Moonlight,
like,
you know, we went to...
Y'all were in some plays at
Well,
wrote,
yeah,
right?
we did, you know, I went to Yale with Terrell, and like, you know, I got my first start on theater here doing a play that he wrote called The Brother Size at the Public, and then he did the trilogy of those said plays, and Sterling was in them.
Yeah.
And the thing that, you know, me and Sterling, like, just when I talk about that brother kind of thing, fraternal kind of thing, excuse me, it was immediate. So
look
like,
at you know how to hit the cough
button.
Yeah,
I know the cough
he
button.
He knows how to hit the cough button. Hey. He's getting applause from the engineering booth.
I'm about this life.
Yeah.
but yeah, so like, there was nothing greater than to get up every day and go to this theater and do this work and this art with this person.
Yeah.
Because, like, the excitement of watching him talk about, like, movies that he's watched or actors that he reveres or things like that. Like, we had the same kind of thing. And, you know, and but, like, the theater, the world in itself just kept making it impossible for us to act with each other. Like, we would be acting adjacent.
Really?
You know what I mean? Like, there was never any time that we had scenes that we were, like, together. Like, we would be adjacent from each other. But I just always admired him. Like, to know that you had the love of this person that, like, you know, wants to see you shine. Like, you winning is him winning and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and I learned from him, you know, because he is my elder. He's older than me. I don't know if you guys knew that, but he's
How old
older.
Is he?
Nah, he's older. anyway, I'm saying
but
that.
I read somewhere that you guys bonded because he helped you shave.
Oh,
I read all the things
at Sundance, I had to play a drag queen, and like he was like the house father because you know, like in the drag and especially in the black drag ballroom scene, like there's families and houses.
Yeah.
So like he was the father.
What
of
would
that
your house,
house
be called?
My house.
If you had to make a house,
Gooey Butter Cake, I think. Because I'm really obsessed with Gooey Butter Cake, and I was like, that's a great name for it. I was like,
why would my house be?
Plus, I think Balenciaga and like all that other stuff is taken, but I was like, mine would be really abstract.
I'd be like, House of, I'm tired.
He's
just House of...
I'm tired.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, I'm tired.
I'm tired. Anyways, I took her off the topic.
Yeah, anyway, like, I had not shaved my face in a long time. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'd ever shaved my face because mm-hmm. I was, like, keeping my facial hair in form of protest.
How long
was
it?
It was, that's the thing. It never grows. Like, I called my facial hair taco meat. Cause it kind
of. I call my chest hair taco meat. Like I'm taco telling meat. You everything
yeah,
today.
Like
sorry.
but I was like, it's like taco meat. And so I was like, well, I can't possibly play this drag queen with all this on my face, but I didn't bring any clippers because we were in Park City, Utah.
And you weren't going to find a black barbershop
at
in Park
all.
City,
like,
Utah.
Anywhere. He was like, man, I'll shave your face, man. I got you, man. I was like, that's love. Like, for
that's
another
love.
Man to do that for another dude, like, that's love. And then he, like, made sure I kept this little triangle underneath my
lip.
Oh,
you kept your soul patch.
Well, we call it soul patch, but he told me that his grandmother told him that it's called the flavor saver.
Why is it called the flavor?
You think about it.
Oh, because the food say
no. That could it could also be for something else. And that's when I was like, oh, we're friends now. Like,
and the rest is
and
history.
And the rest is history.
And he's the guy you're calling the day you both get Emmy nominations.
Man, I mean, like,
that's a beautiful thing.
I don't know, man. He is truly an inspiration. I'm also the godfather to his firstborn son.
Andrew, really?
Which I still am in shock about. Like, and I love this
wow.
this little man so much. And
how old is he?
Oh, my God. Andrew's got to be almost 7 now.
Oh, wow.
So, like, but he's just growing so fast.
My godson is 8.
So you are a godfather.
I'm a godfather.
So you know the feeling of being a godfather.
It is so great because you just get to be there and inspire the good stuff.
Which is not what I do. I try to make sure that he undermines his parents all the time when I'm not there. So I'm like, yeah, oh, they told you that. Well, you should do this.
My new thing is now when I bring him gifts, I try to bring him gifts and his sister gifts that will be like the most annoying to the parents.
That's what godparents are supposed to do.
Yeah. Love you, Aaron and Moose.
Oh,
these
my
are his
God.
Parents.
Andrew, you're my favorite. So are you, Amari. I love you as well, man.
This is crazy. So, I mean, you got to go. I would talk. We
hey,
would.
Man,
this,
look,
this is.
Hey, I'm in
really,
New York. I'm here. I'm literally here.
You're literally
for months,
here.
So.
Yeah. I'm actually, funny story, I'm here all week. I'm based in D.C. I'm moving back to L.A.
Wait, you didn't say anything about that. As I sat here and talked to you about D.C., you didn't say anything about D.C. Where in D.C. are you at?
I live in Noma, which wasn't a neighborhood 5 years ago.
I know it definitely wasn't. That's north of Massachusetts, right?
How do you? Yeah,
because I grew up in D.C. for a big part of my life.
Up?
I grew up in Northeast, Southeast D.C., Alabama Ave, Minnesota Ave. I went to Benning Elementary. My mother taught at, like, Davis Elementary.
Really?
And my sisters are still there. They're like... It's the DMV.
It's the DMV.
So,
do you go back still?
Yes.
It's
to go
so
back.
Different now.
First of all, U Street. I was
first
like,
of all, H Street.
Yeah. I was like, wait, there's a Bonobos?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we've got a Warby Parker here?
Now Ivy City's happening, and I'm like, no one used to
Anacostia
be over there.
Anacostia Park used to be where you go on roller skate and you get your ass out before 8 p.m., and now they're building condos.
Oh, dude. Have you been to the Wharf yet?
Yeah, my family works at the Wharf. Yeah,
really?
My brother-in-law works at the Wharf.
I first got to D.C. in 2009. I would have never imagined a thing like that there.
And here's the thing, that art installation they have of the man coming out of the sand.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
Uh-huh.
So I grew up being terrified of that thing because it used to be in the mall, like where the monument was and everything.
Oh, yeah.
And my mother was like, that's Jesus. You see, that's Jesus Christ.
Stop.
And I would scream.
Your
it
mom
was so
sounds like my mom.
It was terrifying. And so now they moved that art installation to the Wharf. And I was like, and I went down there. I was like, I'm not going down those stairs to see that. I don't need to see it. And like, my friends are sitting on it. And everyone was like, holes, man.
Yeah.
Like, but that's home, man. Yeah.
I lived in D.C. first from 2009 to 2012. Then I was in L.A. at our West Coast office for a while.
Wow.
Then I came back to D.C. because I covered the election. But at the end of this month, I'm moving back to L.A.
Oh, damn.
I miss L.A.
So will you ever come back to D.C.?
Of course.
Okay.
I mean, because our headquarters are in D.C.
And plus, that's the only place you can get chicken wings and mambo sauce, homie. Like, that's the best, like...
Yeah,
why
but you know what
me?
I
why
miss,
Why are you looking
though?
At me like you're crazy?
Like, being in California, it turned me into, like, a California foodie. And
so
I'm
sushi.
Like, this sushi, this all this farm-to-table.
But if
the avocados
you
are better.
You just talked about Ivy City. You don't think D.C. is about to become just like that? Chesapeake Bay's right there.
True.
Don't do this to me. Don't do this to us. We just created.
Listen,
why
this friendship
this?
Will last the ages. I'm gonna be in your circle and I'm not gonna be a square.
No,
I
don't
promise.
Be a square. You'll probably be the only square peg that could be in the circle. We just gotta make the circle bigger.
That's right. I really enjoyed this. I am so excited for this renaissance in black prestige film and TV.
Let's do it.
I'm so happy to see your part in that whole landscape.
No, thank you.
Thank
dude.
You.
It was absolute delight, man, to meet you.
Many, many thanks again to Brian Tyree Henry. He is up for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy at next month's 2018 Emmy Awards. Those are on September 17th. Also up for an Emmy for Outstanding Actress in a Comedy, my next guest, Rachel Brosnahan. She is the star of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel from Amazon. On the show, she plays Midge Maisel, this 1950s housewife from New York City. She kind of stumbles into a career in stand-up comedy. The show is a brainchild of Amy Sherman-Palladino. She is the creator of Gilmore Girls. Rachel and I talked late last year, just before she won a Golden Globe Award for her work on the show. I kind of think our chat was something of a good luck charm. All right, here's me talking with Rachel Brosnahan, star of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. This show, for those listening that have not watched the show yet, how would we describe the show for listeners without giving all the stuff away?
Right. So this is a show about a young mother and housewife in the 1950s. She lives in New York on the Upper West Side. She has a perfect life. She'll be the very first person to tell you it's by her own design. And one day, her perfect husband up and leaves her for his awful secretary. And through a series of both fortunate and unfortunate events, she ends up pursuing a new career in stand-up comedy.
Yeah. And, like, this comes about, her pursuing stand-up, after her husband who leaves her has tried to make it himself, and he's not that funny, and he's also stealing jokes.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
He literally is the worst.
Yeah, fully the worst.
I want to play a clip of the show where you are doing that stand-up routine.
Oh, gosh.
In your, like, night clothes, drunk and out of it, and it's the first time everyone realizes that, like, damn, you have the range. You have the gift.
I was a great wife. I was fun. I planned theme nights. I dressed in costumes. I gave him kids, a boy and a girl. And yes, our little girl is looking more and more like Winston Churchill every day, you know, with a big Yalta head. But that's not a reason to leave, right?
I loved him. And I showed him I loved him. All that they say about Jewish girls in the bedroom, not true. There are French whores standing around the Marais district saying, did you hear what Mitch did to Joe's isn't
There is so much in there. Like, what I love about it, like, you're not just delivering the lines perfectly. You are doing the best physical presentation that the best stand-up comics do. Because, like, so much of comedy, I feel like, is performing with your body as well as, like, your voice. How hard was it for you to become that? Like, you aren't a trained stand-up comic. This is unlike roles you've done before.
Yes.
What was the prep like?
Well, thankfully, we had a lot of prep before we shot the pilot, more than you normally get, I think. We had a couple weeks, and so Amy and Dan and I sat down a lot. And
we should say who they are.
Yes, the creators, writers, directors, they wear 12,000 hats of our show.
And they're a married couple, right?
Yes, they are. And we had a lot of time to sit down, and I asked them 12 gazillion questions, and they would give me 12 gazillion and a half answers. And then, and so by the time we performed that first one in the first episode, I was ready to put it out there. You know, we'd been working on it for such a long time. It felt ready. But also, I think Midge isn't really doing stand-up at all until much, much later in the season.
Yeah.
This is a woman who's fully having a breakdown. Her entire life has crumbled, and everything she thought she knew is a lie. And that is just a person.
Yeah.
It's not yet a stand-up. And coupled with Amy's brilliant and hilarious writing, that's what you get.
Yeah.
I feel like I had a way in as an actor and a person who comes from a more dramatic background. And I was fortunate enough to be able to take this parallel journey with Midge.
Yeah.
We got to learn the more technical sides of comedy together. And it was fun and petrifying and and exhilarating all at the same time.
And I mean, so like you mentioned, the writing that they're doing on this show,
yeah.
It is a lot of fast monologuing and just like a lot of dialogue, period.
Yeah.
And you've spoken about how much dialogue y'all have in this show. How hard was doing that?
So, so hard. There's never enough time to prep. There's never enough time. There's never enough coffee. It truly involved actual mouth warm-ups pre every one of those speeches.
I saw that. You said that you do like Shakespearean mouth warm-ups. Do one for me.
Well, Shakespearean is a little bit of an overstatement.
Okay.
I was just going to say, like, all that weird stuff that is going to sound even weirder over the radio than it would look in person, and it looks pretty weird.
I like weird.
But, you know, you go, ba 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 baby bee bye bo boo ka 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 ki kai ko koo da 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 di do do fa 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 fi 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 fo foo. You know, that kind of
thing. I can't do that. Wait, let me try it.
Yeah, go.
Okay, tell me again.
So it's the letters of the alphabet.
Oh.
B, C, D,
B, C, D.
Ba-ba-ba-baby-bi-bi-bi-bi-bo-boo.
Ba-ba-da-bi-bi-bi-bi-bi-boo. Nope, I can't.
Hello, Mary Poppins.
That's hard.
It's hard, but it helps.
Yeah.
If you practice every day, you're going to be even better than you already are at this job.
I'm going to do it.
I promise.
I'm going to practice.
I can't wait. Wait, try one more time just for me because it's fun.
Bibbidi-bobbidi. Wait, not bibbidi.
Ba-ba-ba-baby. That was pretty good.
Thank you.
See, you can be it too.
That's
right. You can
be
a stand-up too. A TV stand-up. It's not the same thing.
I was reading that when you auditioned for the show, you had to basically deliver the stand-up comedy monologue in front of an empty room, which is hard enough. But on top of that, you were, like, almost deathly ill during the audition. Like, how sick were you?
I think maybe me making some bad jokes has gotten slightly exaggerated through the course of all this press. I was not knocking on death's door, but I felt terrible.
Okay. Was it, like, the flu or what?
I don't know. I mean, I've been calling it the plague because that's what it felt like.
Nice.
You know how normally you have a flu or something, and 3 or 4 days in, you begin to see the light.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 10 days later, I still could not get out of bed.
Oh, that's not good.
I mean, so sick. I was just a sweaty, gross, snotty mess. And I actually had to cancel my first appointment because I was so sick reschedule. But I was so scared that they were going to just move on.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, I don't come from comedy, so nobody had any reason really to believe that I could do this without seeing me do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I rallied way too soon, and oh, man, you know, like, I had to take my shoes off at some point during this audition.
Why?
Because my feet were so sweaty.
Ooh.
I couldn't walk in them.
Ooh,
it was gross. It was so, I've never been grosser.
Oh, my goodness. And if I recall correctly, the show's creators said that they couldn't tell.
They're being very kind. I mean, Amy did once or twice have to stop me to tell me to powder my face. There was a lot of sweating happening. But some part of it was convincing. And, you know, not all that dissimilar from some of Midge's
stuff. From the scenes. Because, like, when she's on stage sometimes, it is, like, a little kind of breakdown-y.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, the show is set in 1958, if I recall correctly, and y'all get the period piece nature of this down to, gosh, a science. The wardrobes are on point. Like, those Upper West Side apartments, like, had me shook. I was like, I want to live there. I want
me
to
too.
Live to there. Like, it's so beautiful. Like, one, did you get to keep the wardrobe? And two, like, what was the level of specificity and detail about making sure this thing totally looked and felt 1958?
Oh, man. Well, I'm sure that I was insulated from a lot of it, but I know that we had all the different departments working together to make sure that this both felt exactly true to 1958, and there's also a certain level of fantasy to this show. There's a little bit more color.
Hmm.
There's a musicality to our world that is slightly heightened.
Huh.
But, man, those apartments are incredible. We actually shot in two real apartments for the pilot on 113th and Riverside.
Yeah.
And they replicated them exactly on our stage for the rest of the show.
Wow.
Yeah, the costumes are extraordinary. I haven't gotten to keep any of them yet.
Need to let you keep the costumes.
Well, we have a season two.
Well, there's that.
we knew that before we finished the first, so.
Yeah, okay.
She's going to be repeating some outfits, I think.
Okay.
But one day I'm stealing every single one of those coats.
As you should. All right, time for one more break. When we come back, what the marvelous Mrs. Maisel gets right about female friendships. BRB.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Homes.com. Homes.com knows having the right agent can make or break your home search,
That's why they provide home shoppers with an agent directory that gives you a detailed look at each agent's experience, like the number of closed sales in a specific neighborhood, average price range, and more. It lets you easily connect with all the agents in the area you're searching, so you can find the right agent with the right experience and ultimately the right home for you. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Get your quote at progressive.com and see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them. In your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, one of your new hosts for On Point. We take on the news with the smartest guests and live calls from every corner of the country. NPR's David Folkenflik hosts the Friday Week in the News. Join David and me for On Point.
When did you realize that you wanted to be an actress? Or did you? Did you fall into it? Did you say, like Midge would have when you were like six, I'm doing this? Like, how did it happen?
I kind of did. That's something that Midge and I share in common. When we can't not do anything 125%.
Yeah.
We're also both a little type A. But without necessarily being able to say I wanted to do it all the time, I always wanted to do it. I was very creative. I loved reading because I loved imagining worlds that were different from or bigger than mine. I really loved fantasy, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter. And somehow that translated into wanting to act. I liked doing school plays. And then I think, you know, I could, just like kids say, I want to be a princess or I want to be a vet or a doctor. I kind of went, I'm going to be an actress. But it wasn't until I was in high school and people were deciding what they wanted to study in college.
Yeah.
And I realized that I had no other interests or qualifying skills that I wanted to be an actor.
And you went to Tisch?
I did, yeah.
At NYU, which sounds like it must be like the set of Fame. Like, is everyone just running around singing and dancing and flash mobbing?
No, well, maybe some of the studios.
Just say yes. Please tell me that it's like that, because
yes,
I want to believe that.
It's exactly like that. Wow, how did you know? I mean, I studied at Strasbourg, which I don't know how much you know about Strasbourg, but we were known for crying.
Okay, what is Strasbourg for those who don't know?
You cry all the time. It's one of the studios that, that NYU, so there's NYU is the giant umbrella. Tisch is the larger arts umbrella. Then there's the drama program. And within the drama program, there are a bunch of studios. And drama students get split up into the studios. And you get assigned to a studio based on your audition. And I got assigned to the Lee Strasberg Theater and Film Institute.
They assigned you to the crying theater.
They did. I don't know what that says about me. But they turn you inside out. They look at all your guts. And then they try to piece you back together again. Or they leave you on your own to piece yourself back together again. But I learned a ton. I really did. And I loved my time there.
So coming out of the crying studio at NYU, did you expect to be in this show that is really, really funny?
No.
Okay.
No. Absolutely not. I don't think anybody really expected this.
Yeah. So were you scared to do it? Like, was this a big departure from your previous work?
Yes. Absolutely petrified. Every single minute. I'm still petrified.
Really? Because you look flawless in the show. You look like you are just made of steel.
Then I'm a brilliant actor. I have never been so scared. Maybe that's not what everybody wants, but that's what I want. I've always wanted to do things. You hear actors say this all the time, to do things that scare me, to do things I've never done before, to stretch my muscles and see if I can, I guess. And I loved this part, and I felt like I had a way in. As I said, she doesn't start a comedian. She is a woman who is funnier than Rachel. Yeah. Thanks to Amy's brilliant writing. But she's a person, and she's a beautifully complex, fully realized woman. And and so I was hoping I could find her.
You did. And, I mean, to be fair, you aren't – it's not all laughs. Like, there is this one scene where your character Midge kind of has this breakdown in front of Susie, who is her, quote, personal manager slash agent.
Yes.
Susie's being tough on Midge, and Midge has had it.
Just drop this doe-eyed Bambi thing right now. I'm so sick of you acting all innocent. Oh, I don't know how the world works because I'm a housewife and I wear four layers of petticoats. It is tired and it is weak, and you are not tired and you are not f-ing weak. And if you want to be a comic, you are going to have to grow the f- up right now.
I'm sorry. I don't know what to do lately. I'm trying to be strong and independent, but I saw Joel the other night and he was with her, and every time I think I can breathe again, and I'm trying to get it right. I'm trying to figure it out. I know the parties aren't gigs. I know I'm not really doing stand-up. I don't want to be a second-rate Nichols and May. I'd never even heard of Nichols and May, and I've got news for you. If you're going to be a personal manager, then sometimes you're going to have to deal with the personal, and this is personal. All of this. And it's not...
I love how you deliver that line. And this is personal. All of this. I'm like, that's my motto for life. It's all personal.
Especially when there's tears streaming down your face.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Sometimes you're going to have to buy some Kleenex and let me cry and pat me on the back and say they're there.
Okay, that sort of felt like a sigh of relief in a way for me. There aren't very many moments like that in the show. There really aren't any. That's the only time Midge really breaks down.
Yeah.
Including when her husband walks out, you know. I love that scene.
That was good.
A rare moment on our show where Alex Borstein, who plays Susie, and I got to just be and just chuck stuff at each other in a room. Not literally, but, you know.
And Alex Borstein, I mean, like, so I, when one, the show starts, and I was like, oh, my God, I used to love her on Mad TV way back in the day. And this is a totally, a big departure from that show for her. But what I like about the show is that the love story at the heart of at least season one is between your character and her character. And it is it is this story of this friendship between two women and this partnership between two women. And it deals with it in a way that really speaks to the ups and downs of friendship and friendship between women. And I really admire that. Like, you guys will cry and yell and scream and then hang out and work together. And, like, there are these highs and lows. And your show is doing that. Shows like Insecure with Issa Rae have women friendships that are showing all of that.
I was going to say, that's my favorite part about Insecure. That's actually the part that spoke to me the most, is the friendship between those two women. And it was watching that show that made me realize how rare that is on TV.
Yeah.
To see a female friendship that is as complicated as they are.
Yes.
We're complicated beings, and it's a beautiful thing. And that nuance, I think, is something that only female creators, at least at this point in time, can really grasp in all of its, all of it.
Yeah. And, like, I realized watching that scene and then hearing it back now, the beauty of displaying these multifaceted friendships between women is that you can access the full range of human emotion in a way that is not tied to someone's sexuality.
Yes.
And I think that's refreshing.
Well, and I love that it's a budding friendship, too. These are women who, under ordinary circumstances, may never have met, let alone become friends. And not only do they become friends, but they need each other. They need each other to survive. They complete each other. Alex Borstein has coined the term womance.
I like that.
I do, too. It's exactly right. That's everything. That's it. You know, in a show with two bros becoming friends in a significant way, you call it a bromance. And this is a fully realized womance.
I love that.
I do, too.
That's, and so speaking of this romance, like, part of why it works so well is because you had someone like Amy Sherman-Palladino making this show. People might know her from making the show Gilmore Girls. Why is that, you think? I mean, like, she has this really great way of writing, which you see in this show. It's really fast conversations, a lot of pop culture references. Like, what makes her shows, and makes you fit so well in this one?
Well, everything you said. I mean, it is. It's she's got a distinct fingerprint, and if you look closely, you can always tell her shows are her shows. But I think what, you know, this show feels so new. Our show feels so new. I don't know where it belongs in the cultural zeitgeist, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think a show like Gilmore Girls, and I think this is present in our show too, they're just hopeful at the end of the day.
Yeah. That is
which
true.
Is funny because Amy is a self-proclaimed pessimist.
Really?
Yes. But she understands something about it because they're real people who are dealing with real stuff in ways that are not always beautiful, but you walk away feeling like everything's going to be okay. And especially right now, the world is on fire. You know, we need to laugh a little. We need a little bit of hope, a little bit of joy. And I think, without getting too cheese, that's something that these shows have in common, which is why they seem to speak to so many people, like you said, who you wouldn't expect necessarily to enjoy them.
Yeah. The show itself is a comedy, but there are some moments that really are dramatic for me, and I'm thinking of one in particular. Mm-hmm. There is this scene that your character Midge does and her character's mother does. Y'all both are going to bed with your husbands. Midge waits for her husband to fall asleep and then goes to the bathroom and takes off all of her makeup, puts in her curlers, puts on her face mask, then goes to bed. But before she goes to bed after her husband's sleeping, she opens the curtains just enough so that the sunlight will hit her face first in the morning so she can get back up before he wakes up and have her full makeup on in bed so he never sees her unmakeuped.
Yes, sir.
Image's mom does the same thing, and it just stopped me in my tracks. And I said, wow, men walk through the world never even really being aware of, like, how much more stuff women have to deal with.
Totally. And we're seeing that right now in a big way.
Yeah. And, like, it was true in 1958 where this show is set, and it's really kind of still true today. Like, how does it feel to make a show that is about a different decade but feels very timely in regards to the way that our culture and our society treats women who are trying to be taken seriously?
Yeah, it feels important. It feels especially important right now. It felt important while we were making it, but it's taken on a whole new meaning. This is ultimately one show about one woman. But one of the coolest things about this show is that it's created, written, directed, produced, edited, like I said, 12 gazillion hats by this extraordinary woman, Amy Sherman Palladino, and her husband, Dan Palladino, who's an extraordinary man who loves extraordinary women, about an extraordinary woman at a time when it wasn't okay for women to be extraordinary. And we have women in front of, behind the camera, and we're always looking for more. It feels cool. It feels like it shouldn't be so radical anymore to be telling a story about a woman who is amazing, who is like women that I know and love but somehow haven't really seen on TV before.
Mm-hmm.
And I also appreciate about this particular story that it's a slightly different look at a woman reinventing herself in a period piece. This is a woman who arguably isn't a feminist when you meet her. And she's the first person to tell you that. I think if you asked Midge if she was a feminist, she'd go, no, I don't burn my bras. You know? She believes that women have a place. And all this stuff that we're talking about, that scene you reference where she gets up in the middle of the night and puts her makeup on, to us, a modern audience, that feels like a burden.
Yeah.
But to her, it's something that makes her feel good.
Mm.
It's something she genuinely enjoys. And this isn't a woman who came out of the womb feeling like she didn't belong and wanted to change things and push against the walls and expectations that were set up for her. This is a woman who thrived in this environment.
Mm.
And to me, it's exciting to see a different kind of story about a woman that arguably is a feminist story, but who discovers that the world is not as narrow as she thought it was, and that maybe some of the things she thought were true she has questions about, and is noticing things that she never noticed before, noticing a double standard between men and women and the way that women are treated. And I'm really proud to be a part of this.
Yeah. It's so funny you say that the character is noticing things that were not noticed before. And I immediately thought of this Me Too movement. Mm-hmm. And so many people, men and women, are noticing things that were always happening but just never talked about. And I think being almost aghast at how widespread this stuff is.
Yeah.
You know, like, besides just having this show speak to this moment, at least for me, what do you think your character in the show would make of this moment right now, of the Me Too movement?
It's interesting. Midge says something in one of the sort of mid-later episodes that has always just, gotten me in the gut, because it's hard for me to hear and to say as this character that I love something like this. But Susie tells her that that she's been learning things about the apartment building because she's been riding the elevator up and down and listening to people fighting and things. And she says, I think so-and-so grabbed so-and-so's ass. And
now
Mitch
Susie
says,
is her almost manager, quasi-manager.
Yes, becoming her manager. And Susie says, I think so-and-so pinched so-and-so's ass. And Midge goes, well, I hope she did nothing to deserve that.
Mm. I remember that scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so Midge, I think, is somebody who has a lot of learning to do in that department. And that is frustrating to me. I think it should be frustrating, but it represents a point of view that still exists.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that throughout the course of our show, her perspective, and I assume because she will be faced with it personally, her perspective will be forced to change, her eyes will be opened more, but progress isn't linear sometimes.
That's so true.
Almost never linear.
Yeah.
So I hope that for the women out there who are more like Midge, who maybe share some of those more, I hate to use the word conservative, but I suppose that's still what that is, or more...
Yeah, it's okay to use that word, yeah.
Traditional views that way, that may lead them to believe things like that. I hope that they're also listening and that we are able to embrace their learning process, too, and encourage them to learn.
Well, and that is what seems so rare these days. Like, people don't really want to learn from people that don't agree with them. At least
of
it
course.
Seems that way on the internet.
And it's hard because it is frustrating when, and I think this particular time, although so many times have echoed this, I suppose, is so polarizing. Mm-hmm. We're so polarized and it does, and we're learning, I think, that sometimes people we love share these views that we find repugnant, you know?
Yeah.
And so how do you move through that? I don't know. I don't have the answer, but we've got to listen more.
We got to find a way.
More.
Yeah.
We just have to listen better.
Totally.
We're doing a lot of talking and not enough listening.
Rachel Brosnahan up for an Emmy for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for her starring role in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Listeners, have a great Labor Day weekend. Barbecue something, jump in a pool, watch a bad movie. We're going to be back in your feed on Tuesday. We're talking politics with two star reporters, Katie Rogers, who is a White House correspondent for the New York Times, and Jeff Bennett, who has the same title over at NBC News. I asked them both a very simple question. What's it like to cover the White House right now? Y'all, they told me everything. You don't want to miss it. Behind the scenes of the White House press corps, Tuesday. Till then, thanks for listening. I'm Sam Sanders. Talk soon.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell and show up exactly the way you want to. Customize your online store to your style. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
This message comes from The Run-Through with Vogue. Listen as designers, Vogue editors, and industry icons like Erykah Badu and Florence Pugh have in-depth conversations about fashion and culture. New episodes are released each Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.